The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China. Our indispensable daily newsletter features a roundup of the news from hundreds of sources, plus links to the original writing that we have on our website. Sign up for SubChina Access and you get all that and a whole lot more, with stories and everything from the Belt and Road to local entrepreneurship and innovation in China. From the travails of ethnically Chinese researchers in the U.S. in this age of creeping McCarthyism, to China's ongoing extra-legal internment of hundreds of thousands, or by some estimates, well over a million Uyghurs and other Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. We're sure you'll agree that it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from the Seneca South Studio in Durham, North Carolina. Joining me from across the Appalachians in Nashville, Tennessee, is a man riding that fine, fine line between panda hugger and panda slugger, Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn. Jeremy, greet the people, won't you?
Okay, you've unveiled our secret new word to the public, coined by our SubChina colleague, Jesse. Panda slugger is our new word to replace dragon slayer.
Yeah, I like it a lot better.
Thanks, Jesse. Great word. Thank you, Kaiser. I'm doing very well. Very well indeed.
Okay, great. Well, let's jump right in because we have a fascinating topic and a great guest this week. Why and under what conditions does China's military strategy change? How has it evolved over the 70 years since the founding of the PRC? And how does our understanding of China's military strategy and the circumstances that cause it to change, how does that help us to better understand the relationship between the Chinese Communist Party and the People's Liberation Army, the PLA? How does it help us understand China's regional ambitions, China's evolving worldview, the operations of the Chinese political system? Well, joining us from his home in Brookline, Mass, to talk about all of this is the author of a new book about the PLA and its military strategy, Taylor Fravel, in what, if I recall, is his second appearance on the show. But your first one, Taylor, I think was like 6 years ago or so?
6 or 7 years. It actually may have been 2012. 7 years
Ancient
ago.
History.
Oh my gosh. 7 years ago. My Lord. Anyway, Taylor, welcome to the show. Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. Delighted to be here.
You know, you've got so many accolades. I'm just going to quickly, you're Arthur and Ruth Sloan Professor of Political Science and member of the Security Studies Program at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Taylor is also one of the world's leading authorities on the Chinese military and was the author of a book called Strong Borders, Secure Nation, Cooperation and Conflict in China's Territorial Disputes, which was published back in 2008 and which we talked about on our last show. His new book is called Active Defense, China's Military Strategy Since 1949, and we're going to be delving into that for the next hour.
Taylor is one of those people who makes me feel like a complete slacker. He's a graduate of Middlebury College and Stanford University, where he received his PhD. He was also a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, of course, and has another graduate degree from the London School of Economics. He is also principal investigator for the Maritime Awareness Project. Taylor Fravel, welcome back to Seneca.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You know, I'm just going to take some of the air out of this because, you know, that Rhodes Scholarship produced just another BA.
Just another BA.
It wasn't.
and as my wife likes to remind me, I've never really held, quote, a real job in my entire career, so.
Well, you're lucky.
Indeed. Taylor, on this show recently, we've talked quite a bit about grand strategy. So before we really dive in, can you explain the relationship between military strategy and grand strategy?
Sure, yeah, that's a great question to start with. So, I mean, there are different definitions of grand strategy out there, but one common one is that it's a sort of theory of security or a vision of how a state creates security for itself, and in particular, how it uses a combination of diplomatic, economic, and military tools to achieve its sort of broadest political objectives in the international system. And so a military strategy is really about one subset of grand strategy, or one of the tools of grand strategy, namely the military tool. And so it outlines basically the role that military force will play according to the state to achieve its national objectives.
That is a terrific way of distinguishing military strategy from what's above it. So military strategy then is a subset of grand strategy. But how do we distinguish it from what's below it hierarchically? I mean, I assume that there's something at the level of theater operations that is much more than just tactical, but doesn't quite rise to the level of military strategy, just to zero in on what we are talking about in this book.
That's right. So at least in the context of this book, I should probably use the phrase national military strategy, because I'm definitely, in the case of China, focusing on the strategy for the armed forces as a whole and how it thinks about using force. Certainly, in any particular conflict, one might think about strategies in particular campaigns or even in particular theaters of campaigns during wartime. In peacetime, of course, individual military units will practice what's often described as tactics, techniques, and procedures, or how they're going to execute their very specific military operation. And all those things at the operational and tactical level lie below sort of the threshold of national military strategy, which really tries to outline how the armed forces are going to be organized overall, what their main objectives are, and how they're going to pursue or achieve those objectives.
Taylor, one last question on the definition of strategy before we move on to the meat of the book, which is, do your Chinese counterparts look at it in the same way? Do they have the same working definitions of grand strategy and military strategy and what their relationship?
That's a terrific question. I think in terms of military strategy, there's probably pretty wide agreement among sort of military professionals inside China and outside China as to what constitutes military strategy. But of course, everything has Chinese characteristics, and with respect to military strategy, those characteristics have a lot to do with how Mao Zedong defined war in the 1930s and 1940s, even though in some ways he was drawing on the work of a Western military strategist, Clausewitz. But nevertheless, when the Chinese provide official definitions in their military manuals about military strategy, they'll often start with Mao's own definition, but it doesn't differ substantially from definitions that one would use in other countries and contexts. Regarding grand strategy, I'm not sure that it has received as much scholarly attention in China as it has, at least in the United States. Of course, on the one hand, Chinese scholars have written probably tens of thousands of articles and books that have grand strategy in the title, but they never seem to offer a clear and consistent definition of what grand strategy is, although I think probably the essence of it is still nevertheless the same, namely how a state thinks about using its different tools of statecraft, especially the diplomatic, economic, and military tools to achieve its national objectives.
Thanks, Taylor. That clears it up. And I just wanted to make sure we weren't talking about, Martians when the Chinese were talking about people from Saturn. But to get onto the book, it sets out to explain the major changes in military strategy that we've seen since 1949 in China. And you have quite a simple, straightforward thesis about the conditions that seem to produce those major changes. Can you lay that out for us?
Sure. Thanks very much. So basically, the argument that I put forward in the book is that there are two factors that determine when China has been much more likely to pursue what I call a major change in its military strategy. And let me define major change briefly. What I mean here is that the strategy offers a new vision of warfare or how war should be conducted, and requires substantial changes to a military organization that would be reflected in its operational doctrine, which outlines how it will fight, its force structure or the forces that it would use to carry out that doctrine, and then training of those forces in a way that's consistent with the doctrine. So a major change is a really significant shift in how a military might prepare to go to war. And in the book, I offer an argument that explains how this occurs in the Chinese context. And I focus on two parts. The first part has to do with China's external security environment. And in particular, I argue that Chinese military officers pay very close attention to shifts in the conduct of warfare as practiced by other states in the system, especially great powers who have the greatest military capability. Because for much of its history since 1949, China's been what I call a late military modernizer, or a state that is trying to catch up in terms of its military capability and its military power. It watches pretty closely what other countries do. And when in the course of those observations, it detects a significant shift in the conduct of warfare, then that is a cue for China to pursue change in its own strategy. However, there's a catch, or there's a second part to the argument, which has to do with the domestic political conditions that make such a change possible. And here I focus on something called party unity, which I define as agreement among the top party leaders over sort of the structure of authority within the party, as well as the basic policies that the party is going to pursue. And the basic argument here is that when the party is united, it delegates a substantial amount of authority and autonomy to China's senior military officers to engage in all aspects of military affairs, to include revising China's military strategy. So to paraphrase Mae West, when it's good, it's very, very good. When the party is united, the military officers will sort of scan the external security environment and see if a change in strategy is warranted, and perhaps that change that is warranted is a major change. However, when party unity collapses, then it all goes to hell in a handbasket. The PLA becomes paralyzed as a military organization, either because it injects itself into the intra-party politics, or different elites within the fractured party leadership try to woo the military for this reason or that reason. So there are lots of different ways in which party disunity can prevent the formulation of a military strategy. But the main point here is that when the party is united, then the PLA is much more, or the PLA senior leadership is much more likely to propose new changes in strategy and major changes if conditions warrant doing so.
Well, great. And we'll be talking about some of the instances in which these happen and don't happen, whether, you know, there's some change in the way that wars are conducted that would, in ordinary circumstances, under conditions of unity, produce that kind of military strategic change, but don't because of disunity. So we'll talk about that. But I think you make the case for your thesis pretty convincingly. But how would you characterize the significance of knowing this? In other words, how does it change pre-existing or prevailing notions about the dynamics of Chinese military strategy? How does your thesis change that? I mean, I imagine there must have been conventional wisdom of people in your field that got certain things wrong when talking about Chinese military strategy. So what were these common misconceptions? What held sway before?
Sure.
How does that change?
Yeah, no. I think there are probably at least two. The first would be more of an empirical question, simply how the field viewed China's military strategy in the pre-reform period or during the Mao era. And I think for a long time, many people, myself included, before I got into this subject, assumed that throughout the Mao era, China's approach to military affairs was dominated by People's War and guerrilla tactics, right? That it was not a very modern force. Yeah. It was not a very professional force. It was a ragtag force. And it was inherently much more revolutionary than anything else. And one of the big empirical findings that comes out of my research is that the PLA leadership, the senior officers of the PLA, since the very founding of the PRC in 1949, have sought to build a modernized professional military. And so that process happened much earlier than I thought was the case. It was certainly interrupted during sort of the excesses of the Mao era, in particular from the mid-1960s to the late 1980s. But nevertheless, even the modernization drive that we're witnessing today has its roots in the founding of the People's Republic and the desire of the senior military officers at that time to build a modern and professionalized force. So empirically, I think it tells us something new. And then in terms of how we Right. think about military organizations more generally, there's been a very powerful argument associated with Samuel Huntington that military professionalism cannot take root in heavily politicized armed forces. In other words, when elites seek to curry the favor of the armed forces, or when the armed forces are beholden to one political party, then they're much less likely to be professional. And Huntington called this subjective civilian control. The term is a bit of a mouthful, but that's the term he came up with.
And
subjective civilian control. He contrasted this with objective civilian control, which basically said you have to set up a system within your national government that depoliticizes the armed forces, and when they're depoliticized, they will enjoy autonomy and thus engage as professionals. And so the big finding that comes out in terms of civil military relations from my research is that China, on the one hand, or the PLA, on the one hand, is a heavily politicized force, right? It's the armed wing of the Chinese Communist Party, what brought the Chinese Communist Party to power in the revolution. But on the other hand, nevertheless, and actually because it is a party army, because it is beholden just to one political party, nevertheless, under these conditions of party unity, the PLA has enjoyed substantial autonomy that has allowed it to engage in quite a professional manner at certain points in its history.
Yeah, and we're going to get into that. Let's get into that question a little bit later about, I mean, because I think it is a bit counterintuitive to a lot of people to imagine this CCP-dominated army having as much autonomy as you ascribe to it. But let's get into that after we've laid out a little more of your argument, because this comes up when we talk about the 1964 reorganization. But first, some other sort of groundwork before we get into that. So Taylor said that there's this empirical bit of it, so it definitely challenges some pre-existing notions about this idea of people's war, and again, about the autonomy of the military, the relative autonomy of the PLA, even under the CCP, which we'll talk about, as I say, later. What are some of the other things that it sheds light on, other aspects of the mechanisms of control that the party has over the PLA? What else do you think that your work brings to light?
Well, I think it... perhaps can illuminate a couple of other different issues. One might be perhaps too narrowly military, but one thing that I really came away with after doing this research is how much, in some respects, the PLA functions like a party organization and not just a military organization. And so it makes a lot of its decisions by committee, the most important committee of which is the Central Military Commission under the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party itself. And here, of course, the Central Military Commission is technically a party body and not a military body, even though it's almost always been staffed with primarily military officers ever since it was created in its current form in the mid-1950s. But as I looked through even the way in which they would think about changing strategy, they would still, of course, form a committee to explore what to do, right? And they would have these enlarged meetings of the Central Military Commission, which were sort of like party congresses, right? There would be a main work report or a main report that was delivered. You'd have breakout groups that would discuss the significance of the report. And of course, that was part of a process of ensuring that the contents of the report, whatever the topic of the meeting was, would be embraced by the senior leadership. And so in a lot of perhaps somewhat more subtle ways, I came to appreciate something I didn't appreciate before, which is in terms of perhaps its work style, how much like the Communist Party the PLA actually is. And perhaps that's not surprising given that it is part of the Chinese Communist Party. But I had come into this project with a notion that perhaps it was a bit more different, or it might have its own kind of procedures and ways of doing things.
Well, great. Taylor, how does China's rationale for implementing or for not implementing new military strategy differ from the drivers for this in other major states, in other peers that China has? I mean, in other words, isn't it the case that other states would sort of look around them in the world, see new ways in warfighting technologies that have been introduced, make adjustments, and either implement them or not implement them according to whether, you know, they are able to, whether conditions are stable enough at home to make it possible? Is it significantly different than the way other states manage this process?
So I wouldn't say it's entirely different. I would say that there are perhaps some unique features or characteristics of the Chinese case. I don't want to say this is strategy making with Chinese characteristics, but perhaps I'm going to fall victim to that trope.
It's inescapable.
It's inescapable. But perhaps we can think about, you know, what is similar and what's different. And so certainly in other research from this vast literature on military doctrine and innovation that we have in political science, scholars have tended to focus on external factors and prompting states to revise their military strategies. And they focused on sort of four general sort of external motives. One would be one that applies to all states, namely the rise of a new threat that a state hadn't faced before, especially if it was a pressing threat. Then you might see a state retool its military strategy to deal with that threat. again, that applies to most states, would apply to China in some cases too. The second factor that gets a lot of attention is what one scholar calls a reactive change in strategy or a reactive innovation. And this has to do with states that are in pretty intense rivalries with each other. I think the U.S. and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And so they really closely monitor each other's doctrines. And then if they see a shift in the doctrine of their opponent, they're more likely to change their own strategy. And that argument is a bit more restrictive, but nevertheless was applied to, as I said, the U.S. and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. A third class of arguments focuses on the role of new technologies and how states develop new technologies and then think about ways of applying them to warfighting and thus, in essence, develop new ways of warfighting and then develop new strategies to capitalize on those ways of warfighting. And a classic example here would be this crazy notion in, at the turn of the century or last century that you could somehow land airplanes on ships, right? and create the aircraft carrier. But once you created the aircraft carrier, all of a sudden you could do things you never could do before, and that created a whole new kind of set of possibilities for the kinds of strategies you might adopt. But typically, the only states that can engage in or that might change their own strategies for that reason would be those that have an advanced industrialized base that can generate sort of new basic technologies and then think about applying them to warfighting. And then a fourth general factor would be simply that scholars have focused on how a change in a state's interests change its military strategy. And one example here would be the U.S. acquisition of the Philippines, right? All of a sudden changed how the U.S. thought about naval strategy because it had this territory it had to defend in the Pacific Ocean, right? So these can apply to different states at different periods in time. I think changing interests applies specifically or most importantly to rising powers, and this could be a really important driver of China's strategy in the future. And so in some ways, what I focus on in terms of shifts in the conduct of warfare is not separate from these other external factors. It's not like an independent model, but rather it complements what other scholars have focused on before.
Right. I can certainly think of examples of each of these four things that China has confronted as well.
Yeah. So I don't think China's unique in that sense. Where China is perhaps unique is the role in party unity, and namely this idea that we may assume in the context of other militaries, especially Western militaries or militaries in the advanced industrialized countries, that not really facing severe domestic political obstacles to changing strategy if senior officers believe it is warranted, right? Because of the way in which these societies are constituted with, you know, rule of law and constitutions and everything else, that we just assume away that there has to be a domestic political condition that makes a change in strategy possible. And in China, you just can't assume it away. It's a feature of how the Chinese Communist Party governs the country.
Taylor, I just trying to get my rather simple head around the actual creation communication of military strategy. So I'm thinking, say, in the United States, by my understanding, there are some documents, the National Security Strategy, National Defense Strategy, National Military Strategy, Quadrennial Defense Review, and a bunch of others put out by the military, put out by the government, and these set out U.S. strategy. First of all, is that correct? And what is the Chinese equivalent in terms of the sort of setting and then the communication of military strategy? I'm sorry if this question is very basic.
No, not at all. It's a really good question. And actually gets back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of grand strategy and military strategy. So in the U.S. context, you could think of the national security strategy, which is typically published by the White House as setting out the country's grand strategy. Some may dispute that claim, but you know it's a close enough approximation. And then from that follows the National Defense Strategy, which outlines, I think, the basic goals to be achieved through what would then be the National Military Strategy. And then those goals that are contained in the National Military Strategy are often fleshed out in what's known as the Quadrennial Defense Review. Now, the Quadrennial Defense Review is issued every 4 years, but those other three documents are not issued on any particular timetable and can be drafted again whenever an administration thinks it's warranted. Now, in the Chinese setting, one might think about it this way, perhaps. The equivalent of grand strategy would be contained in some part of the work report delivered at a National Party Congress that certainly in the reform era, has been held every 5 years. And then the PLA itself would draft military strategy and something that's known as the strategic guideline or the military strategic guideline, the Zhanlie Fangzhen. And these are basically what embodies national military strategy in a Chinese context. And it's drafted by the Central Military Commission or some component of the Central Military Commission, presented before the entire leadership of the PLA in what's known as an enlarged meeting of the PLA, which usually gathers together the top 200 to 300 officers, and then agreed upon at that meeting. Now, it will typically receive the consent or the approval of the top party leader, but they will be approving it in their capacity as chairman of the Central Military Commission, not really in their capacity as General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party. And so once the Central Military Commission decides upon a new strategic guideline, it is then the duty and obligation of the PLA to determine how best to carry out and implement that guideline going forward.
And this is all done fairly publicly then, right? I mean, not the meetings themselves, but the product is accessible to anyone who cares to read it, right?
So no, this is actually a huge difference between the U.S. and the Chinese systems. So in the United States, you can Google national security strategy, national defense strategy, national military strategy, and find PDFs of all the relevant copies that have been produced in the digital age, and maybe even some scans of those that were from the pre-digital age. In China, however, because the military is part of the party, military decisions are usually not widely communicated outside of military channels. And so certainly the top party leadership would be aware of a change in the strategic guideline, but it would not be contained in a document that would be uploaded to a PLA website that anyone in China or outside of China could then download. And this actually is one challenge I faced in identifying all of the times that China did change its strategy, because none of these documents are ever published at the time in which the decision is made. Sometimes we have copies of the report in which the strategy was changed that are in the archives and subsequently published. And other times, all we have are accounts of the strategy being changed, contained in memoirs of party officials and senior military officers.
Taylor, so it can't just be sort of teased out of the work reports that are given every 5 years?
No, so it's generally not contained in the work report.
Oh, I see.
So the work report would simply just kind of outline the basic objectives that the party is pursuing, and that's the context in which a military strategy might be formulated. So in that sense, the work report could approximate kind of laying out the grand strategic objectives, but then it would still be up to us, the military, to decide how to do that. And you could think of this perhaps with an analogy to the economic policymaking realm. So we do know, right, there are these economic work conferences. They typically happen every year towards the end of the year to kind of plan economic work for the coming year. And they presumably produce a set of documents that then guide economic work for the coming year. In the case of military strategy, it follows the same model, except that they don't necessarily have a meeting to reconsider China's military strategy every year. Certainly, the Central Military Commission has it in large meetings several times a year, but it would be up to the leadership of the Chinese military to decide when to pursue a change in strategy.
Right. Speaking of changes in strategy, let's get back to the main meat of the book here. You talk about three, maybe you could say four major changes. So you have the 1956, the possibly 1964, though we'll talk about why you don't really quite include that, 1980 and 1993. And there are a few sort of minor adjustments thrown in 77, in 1988, and then the 2004 and 2014 changes that you talk about at greater length. So but let's go back to the first couple first and deal with them fairly succinctly, hopefully, in the 1956 strategy, which is called Defend the Motherland, right? Or that's the name that.
Yes.
So what were the international changes in warfare that drove the change, and what was the political situation internally at that time, 56? So we're talking the eve of the Great Leap Forward, high tide of collectivization. But also, you know, a few years after the end of the Korean War, was the Korean War the factor?
So before I talk about the international factors, let me just briefly set the stage. And the stage would be the nature of the PLA and the Red Army as it was known before the mid-1940s in China, right? And so the way in which the Communist Party came to power was by building a massive light infantry force. And what I mean here is that you had foot soldiers who carried, you know, rifles, submachine guns, perhaps machine guns and mortars, but little else. They didn't have any trucks. They didn't have any tanks. They didn't have any armored vehicles. They had few airplanes and so forth, right? So, and also that's the nature of the force that the PLA went to war with on the Korean Peninsula. And that's important for understanding how Chinese military leaders at the time thought about the kind of military they wanted to build and the kind of strategy that they wanted to pursue. So the main influences in this context were observations of both the fighting in the Second World War, as well as China's own experiences on the Korean Peninsula. And so the Second World War was an example of the mechanization and industrialization of warfare, right? You had U.S. and Soviet and German forces equipped with tanks, armored vehicles, trucks. They could move lots of forces pretty quickly. They could engage in pretty high-intensity operations. They could use a lot of artillery and so forth. And so that really loomed large in the eyes of many people because it was such a significant war in the international system. And so you see Chinese military officers in the early 1950s, even before Korea, talking a lot about World War II and what that means for the kind of military that China itself should develop based upon this light infantry force. When China goes into the Korean War, it engages one of the two most powerful states to emerge from the Second World War, the United States, and it learns a lot of lessons firsthand about just how destructive modern industrialized warfare could be at that time, right? The Chinese light infantry forces were very vulnerable. They faced a lot of constraints in terms of capitalizing on breakthroughs on the battlefield, especially once the United States began to get a better appreciation of Chinese tactics that they were using in Korea. And so you really had these two different influences. I think the overall context would be Chinese assessments of what were the key characteristics of combat in the Second World War and what that meant for building a modern force for the People's Republic of China, and then China's own experience on the battlefield in Korea.
Right. Right.
Now, turning to the domestic political conditions, the early to mid-1950s, and of course it breaks down by the time of the Great Leap, perhaps, but the early to mid-1950s was a period of unprecedented unity among the party. They had achieved victory in the revolution. They had more or less defeated the nationalists, except for Taiwan, and they had this ability now to start engaging in what was described as socialist modernization and building, you know, a strong, powerful, wealthy socialist country. And so there was a lot of unity among the party at this time. Not, of course, complete unity. There's always politics. But nevertheless, there was agreement upon who was the leader, Mao, and there was also agreement on what the basic policy was, which was socialist modernization. And so in that context, the leadership of the PLA, especially Peng Dehuai, had wide latitude to engage in the formulation of military strategy, as well as the design of reforms that would build the PLA into a much more modern force. And some important elements here have to do with the fact that the PLA in the Civil War is not just a light infantry force, or primarily a light infantry force, but also it did not have what military professionals would call standardized tables of organization and equipment, mm-hmm. right? So units from different field armies were trained in different ways, operated in slightly different ways. They might have used different kinds of rifles with different calibers of ammunition and so forth. And so one thing Peng Dehuai knew he had to do was to create a military force that would be uniform, right, so that its full potential could be more easily tapped. And that required instituting a lot of reforms in the early to mid-1950s that then feed in to the adoption of the new strategy in 1956 that can try to take advantage of a force that was more standardized than it had been 10 years earlier during the Civil War.
Great, great, great.
Taylor, you talk about how the PLA's thinking gleaned mainly from the War of Resistance against Japan and from the Civil War casts a long shadow. How would you characterize the major tenets of the 1956 strategy, and how does that long shadow manifest itself?
Sure. So I think I may have already mentioned one of them. And so one tenet is this idea that the PLA was going to be transformed from a light infantry force into a fully modernized military that would have an army, a navy, as well as an air force. And within the army or the ground forces, it would have tanks, artillery, anti-aircraft systems, and so forth, right? So in terms of at least the organizational look and feel, it would be not dissimilar from other militaries at the time. But it casts a long shadow for a couple of other reasons. Firstly, Peng's strategy, or the 1956 strategy, focused on engaging in what the PLA would call positional mm-hmm. warfare. So again, to go back to the Civil War for a minute, there are generally three kinds of warfare that the PLA or Red Army engaged in. There's mobile warfare, in which light infantry forces would basically fight on a fluid front. So they would engage the enemy when they could, especially when they could muster a local superior to forces. And then as soon as they were victorious, they would retreat and disperse, right? So there is no kind of fixed line where the two forces would be facing off against each other. And mobile warfare was the dominant way in which the PLA fought during most of the Civil War. They also occasionally engage in positional warfare where you would defend a fixed position and try to hold territory. And then finally, of course, in areas that have been occupied by the Japanese or the Nationalists, they would engage in guerrilla warfare. But nevertheless, mobile warfare was the dominant way of fighting in the Civil War and for much of the Korean War, at least through the summer of 1951. So this is important in the context of the 1956 strategy because it was a strategy that basically clearly rejected the emphasis on mobile warfare from the Civil War and said, look, we have to try to defend our new country, and we don't want to cede large tracts of land to an invading force if we don't have to do so. And so it was a really significant change in the mindset of the PLA to focus on defending fixed positions or what you might also call a forward defense versus engaging in mobile warfare where you would cede territory if you simply weren't able to control right. it.
That's sort of, you know, more of Mao's lure the enemy in deep, which is sort of the nature of the 64 strategy.
Exactly. So, and this comes, so what this focus on forward defense and a standardized, modernized force, you know, first appears in 1956, and as we'll talk about in a minute, it comes back pretty significantly in 1980.
Right, this idea of
this interregnum of 1964.
Active defense, the title of the book. You know, you're talking about the 1950s as a period of pretty unprecedented party unity. I would certainly agree. Presumably, though, there were times when there were major changes in the conduct of warfare internationally that Beijing would certainly have been wise to, would certainly have seen, but that somehow didn't result in changes of strategy because, if your theory holds, because those changes took place during periods of relative disunity within the Chinese leadership. So what were some examples of periods of disunity that happened to come after some otherwise teachable moment in international war fighting?
So I would highlight two in particular. We may get to them a bit more in a minute, but one would be the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, sometimes also referred to as the Yom Kippur War.
Uh-huh.
So this had really important lessons for the role of armored warfare in modern warfare at the time, as well as the role of air power. And it actually probably was a pretty important window into how the Soviets would invade China, which China feared they would do. But because of the upheaval of the Cultural Revolution, to include the purge of Lin Biao and his associates from, or the death of Lin Biao and then the purge of his associates from the PLA, the ongoing struggle between the radicals and others before the death of Mao, then after the death of Mao, the struggle between Deng Xiaoping and Hua Guofeng, the party was, or the military was not able to act upon this conclusion that the nature of warfare had changed and it might need a new strategy to deal with the Soviet invasion. So that's probably the best single example. A second example would have to do with China's somewhat delayed response to the Gulf War. Now, the Gulf War throughout the world, I think, had a really significant impact on how all militaries viewed the nature of military operations. And I think China probably would have responded immediately to the Gulf War and tried to change its military strategy if it had not been for the upheaval in elite politics after the crackdown and massacre in Tiananmen Square, which really put Deng Xiaoping on his back foot. And he had to spend a couple of years kind of rebuilding his authority in the party and rebuilding consensus around continuing reform. So I would focus on those two. But the best example, I think, would be the 1973 Arab-Israeli War and the fact that it took China 7 years to develop a strategy to deal with how they believed at the time, in the early to mid-1970s, the Soviet Union would attack China.
So we'll touch on the Gulf War again, but let's move now to the 1980 strategy to active defense, which is the title track from this book. Why does it merit this distinction, or is it just that the 1993 strategy, which was called winning local wars under high technology conditions just wouldn't have been a particularly sexy title.
That would not have been sexy. And actually, the full title would have had to have been Winning Local Wars Under Modern, Especially High Technology Conditions. So, oh, you know, wow. As my editor says, this book will appeal primarily to dedicated readers. But I think if I had chosen that title, there would have been even fewer dedicated readers.
So active defense.
So active defense. I mean, the word, so the concept of active defense is associated with sort of the early period of the Civil War in the 1930s, and then Mao's writings about the operations and the encirclement campaigns at that time. And so it's a strategic concept that really kind of flows through China's approach to strategy after 1949. And every strategy is said to be consistent with the principle of active defense. And the basic idea here is that strategically, China is defensive. It's not offensive. It's not an aggressor. It's not a hegemon. But nevertheless, to achieve these defensive goals, it will, at the operational and tactical levels of warfare, use offensive operations and means.
Right.
The reason why it gets used in 1980 is because of the strategy that was adopted in 1964. So if we can talk about that for a minute, let me just...
Sure. Again, so this is lure the enemy in deep, which is,
lure the
as
enemy
you argue,
in
it's, a,
deep.
It's a throwback, right? It's sort of...
It's a total throwback.
Right, right.
So as Mao becomes more radical, and I will save the full story for the reader if they want to get into it, but basically in the early to mid-60s, Mao becomes more concerned with the revisionism within the party, and he becomes increasingly radicalized leading up to the outbreak of the Cultural Revolution. And during this time, he basically rejected Peng Dehuai's strategy of a forward defense, which ironically enough had been embraced by Lin Biao after Lin Biao took charge of military affairs after Peng was purged at the Lushan Conference. And so China continues his emphasis on forward defense until 1964. Mao comes in and says, let's go back to the strategy we used in the 1930s, which is to allow the enemy to penetrate deeply into China and then wear them down in the sea of people's war and so on and so forth. From a professional military sort of officer's perspective, this was terrible, right? Because if your task is to defend the sovereignty of your state, then the last thing you want to do is deliberately allow your adversary to come in and seize territory and perhaps weaken your overall war potential. So this strategy that Mao devised, and this is the only time that a party leader intervened to really change strategy decisively in China. And the reason why, and the name that's given to it is active defense, luring the enemy in deep, right? So active defense and luring the enemy in deep are placed on the same level, or they're given the same importance in strategy. So fast forward to 1980, the senior military officers who watched what happened in the Arab-Israeli War, who considered how the Soviet Union might invade China from the north and seize Beijing, which is only roughly about 500 kilometers from China's border with Mongolia, which at that point was an ally of the Soviet Union. So they thought this idea of basically ceding Beijing to their arch enemy was terrible, right?
Sure.
Like, why would you want to do that? Because it would have a huge impact on China's ability to mount a more protracted resistance. It would devastate morale if the capital was seized and so on and so forth. And so starting really a few years earlier, you see senior military officers, especially two in particular, one is a guy named Su Yu, the other named Song Shulin, start saying that luring the enemy in deep is kind of strategic suicide. We need to stop planning to do it. And so when the PLA finally is able to change its strategy in 1980, the easiest way to do it was to agree to drop luring the enemy in deep from the formulation of the strategy, which left active defense.
Yeah.
So it wasn't put there to necessarily emphasize that strategy was more active defense than previous strategies, but it was the easiest way to make a change in the guideline overall by simply dropping the second half of the formula that had been developed in the mid-1960s.
Taylor, you just mentioned the Arab-Israeli War and other international events as being behind some of the reasons behind the change. But what about the Vietnam War or the punitive strike into Vietnam in 1979? Why should we not read the change in strategy as a response to the poor performance in Vietnam in 1979, given that it came immediately afterwards.
Right, right. Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So I try to make the case in the book that it wasn't nearly as important as people have thought for a couple of reasons. The first was that when Deng decided to attack Vietnam, he and the rest of the PLA High Command knew that the PLA was in terrible shape, right? And so it wasn't as if they went to war with a military they thought was pretty good and were surprised by the outcome. They actually went to war with a military they knew was pretty bad and perhaps shouldn't have been at all surprised by the outcome. And there's very clear documentary evidence to this effect. They even, you know, postponed the invasion of Vietnam for a month to give the recruits who had only entered the PLA in December a few more weeks to train before they would fight, right? I mean, this is not, you know, playing a winning hand. But there are also perhaps some other reasons. The first has to do with the fact that senior officers like Su Yu and like Song Shulin had identified the need to change strategy several years earlier. And that appeared to be, in my view, what was decisive. And then finally, when you look at the meeting in September and October of 1980 to change strategy, there are almost no references to the Vietnam War.
And in 1980, that was still sort of the live threat.
The lessons of invading Vietnam would not necessarily translate in how to defend China against a Soviet invasion, because the way in which they invaded Vietnam was very different than the way in which they thought they would have been invaded by the Soviets. The concern about, you know, the Soviet threat was really intense in the very late 70s and early 1980s. I remember that the Soviet Union aligned its formed a treaty alliance with Vietnam, which was, of course, I think the main reason why China decided to attack Vietnam at that time. It also was escalating the war in Afghanistan, and Afghanistan is a neighbor of China's, but I think more generally, it simply revealed to China how malign the Soviet Union possibly was. Wow. And roughly at this time, there were, I want to say, 50 Soviet infantry divisions deployed along China's northern border, both in the Russian Far East as well as in Mongolia. So it was a real threat from their perspective. It was roughly a quarter of the Soviet army was deployed against China. Now, it wasn't the best quarter of the Soviet army. It was probably the worst quarter. But nevertheless, I think from Beijing's perspective, it was a serious threat that needed to be dealt with more effectively than allowing the Soviet Union to drive straight in and to seize Beijing and other key cities.
So let's jump forward to 1993, the 1993 strategy, Winning Wars Under High-Tech Conditions. Not very sexy book title. What does that translate to in terms of structural changes to the PLA? Where funding goes, what weapon systems are emphasized?
Great, that's a good question. So the main and most significant change, I think, associated with 1993 is this idea that the PLA needed to be able to conduct joint operations, namely operations that would combine the forces of the three services, the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. And so one thing that comes out of the 1993 strategy is this explicit call to be able to conduct joint operations. And this is a dramatic departure even from the strategy adopted in 1980, which focused primarily just on conducting better combined arms operations within the ground forces, or namely improving the ability of infantry, armor, and artillery sort of to work together on the battlefield. And so this was a huge sea change. So starting in 1993, you no longer see Chinese strategists talking about how to combine mobile warfare and positional warfare, or even asking if guerrilla warfare even had a role today. And in the 1980 strategy, they were still sort of talking about military operations in a Chinese context in those terms. And so I think this is the point in time, 1993, when China really decides it's going to try to wage war in a completely different way than it had in the past. And it was enabled or believed it could do so in part because it no longer faced a existential threat of invasion from the Soviet Union or previously in the 1950s from the Americans. And so the national objectives for using military force had changed from sort of ensuring the survival of the country to prevailing in territorial disputes, primarily, as well as Taiwan's unification. What this means in a practical sense is an effort to reduce the size of the army and to increase the relative size of the Air Force and the Navy. And by reducing the size of the army, freeing up more and more resources to invest in higher end or high end naval equipment and air power.
I see. I see. And again, just to match this up with your thesis about political unity, after 1992, with the journey to the south, whatever the southern tour,
southern tour,
right? At that point, the conservatives or the sort of hardliners, the Chun Yun faction, has been sort of shelved. There is no more debate over reform, and there is then political unity, so they're able to go ahead with that. But my question is, why do you regard the 2004 and 2014 adjustments to the 1993 strategy? You don't call them quite, you know, new military strategies. Are they just sort of winning local wars under even more high-tech conditions?
Basically. So the reason why I don't view them as major changes, I think, is twofold. One is that they don't have a new vision of warfare, right? They both are still premised on the idea that warfare is fundamentally influenced by the way in which high technology is being applied to warfighting, although the last two strategies focus on the role of informatization, which is a terrible Chinese...
Xinxihua.
Xinxihua. It's a word that just defies translation into English, right?
Right.
So they define what high technology means in warfare as informatization, but they still believe in focusing PLA operations on joint operations. They're still focused on prevailing in these main sovereignty disputes, Taiwan, the border with India, the South China Sea. And so there isn't really a new vision about how the PLA should fight. It's sort of refining the vision that's first articulated in 1993. And so as a result, you don't see, with one exception of the 2014 strategy, you don't see the PLA engaging in fundamental changes to its operational doctrine, to its force structure, or to training.
Okay.
This, of course, raises the question of what's going on with the reforms, right?
Right.
And so the argument I try to make in the book is that the 2014 strategy was adopted to provide the high level or strategic rationale for undertaking the really gut-wrenching reforms that PLA needed to undertake to truly be able to conduct joint operations, right? So these are reforms that were implied by the previous strategies, but the PLA itself as an organization could never fully reorganize its structure to be able to conduct joint operations effectively. And in particular, there's probably a lot of drift in the PLA in the Hu Jintao era, in part because he wasn't as sort of actively involved or interested in military affairs. And so this is a huge change. I don't want to downplay this change.
This
reorganization is unprecedented. It's the biggest reorganization of the PLA since the 1950s. It dramatically reduces the influence of the ground forces, which I think have been the main obstacle to really pursuing the reforms that were needed to engage in joint operations. But it's not a new vision of warfare.
It's a HR change, not a new strategy.
Yeah, it's not a new strategy, but it's finally changing the PLA to be able to carry out the earlier strategies, of course, updated for their assessment of the role of informatization and warfare at any given point in time. And so it's a hugely significant change. If these reforms are successful, they're going to significantly increase the military effectiveness of the PLA. And for that reason, one could make the case perhaps that 2014 was a major change in strategy, even though I don't think it was a major change in strategy. It certainly was a major change in the organization of the PLA.
Sure. They'd finally got rid of Guo Boxiong and Xu Caiho, and
But one thing I learned in the course of doing this research is that some of the ideas that are associated with the 2016 reforms, you know, have their origins in debates over how the PLA should be organized in the early 1980s.
Huh.
So in 1982, there is a pretty significant discussion of whether they should create a separate ground forces headquarters, because at that time, basically the General Staff Department, which also oversaw the Air Force and the Navy, was the de facto headquarters for the Army. And they thought to improve relations among the services, the ground forces or the Army should have its own headquarters. And that's what finally happened in 2016, you know, first mooted in 1982. And so there's clearly an awareness, I think, in the PLA of the kinds of changes it needed to make. And this is perhaps one of the ways in which being a military that's part of a Leninist party is not so conducive to your professionalism, in that it can perhaps sort of degrade or delay the process of perhaps the most important institutional changes.
Taylor, can we talk about China's nuclear strategy, which, as you point out, is quite separate from other military strategy and doesn't play by the same rules that you laid out? It also doesn't seem to have changed much over the years, even as conventional strategy has changed considerably. Can you talk a little bit about nuclear strategy and the role of the second artillery?
Sure. So in the book, I call it the exception that proves the rule. So as I hope our listeners now know, right, the case I try to make in the book is Chinese military strategy has been quite dynamic since 1949. The reason why it's been dynamic and there's been nine different strategies and three major changes is because the PLA, under these conditions of party unity, is empowered or given significant leeway and autonomy to change strategy when it believes it's appropriate to do so. But nuclear strategy is the one element of China's national defense policy that the party never delegated to the PLA, right? And so the reason why it doesn't change is because the PLA never basically got ownership of the issue. And the reason why it was never delegated is because nuclear weapons were seen to be so supremely important for China and for the party leadership that they wanted to maintain a very close hold on how they would be used and what kind of strategy would be developed for their use. And so one of the hallmarks of China's approach to nuclear strategy from 1964 is this pledge that it will not use nuclear weapons first, which means it's going to have a relatively small arsenal designed to deter attacks on China, but not to conduct first strikes against other countries. And so it's what's known as a secure second strike. And Chinese leaders believe if you have a secure second strike, then you can deter nuclear use against China. And that will fundamentally increase China's security, even if you still have kind of conventional conflict with other countries. So the second artillery was set up to be the custodian of China's nuclear forces, but not a part of the PLA that would have any input into the formulation of what China's nuclear strategy should be.
Just to give the listeners a sense of the kinds of gems buried in this book, there's that great section where you talk about the development about China's nuclear testing in 1963 and the code names that they assigned within the Politburo Standing Committee, I guess, to the development of the nuclear program. The bomb was called Qiu Xiaojie, right? Like Miss Qiu.
Yeah.
and like the launch platform was called her Shuzhuang Tai, her like makeup table, her dressing table or whatever, and then the test launch was called Shu Bianzi or something like that. It's just really very funny. I would love to find those communiques, you know, talking in this weird language. It's like
these were the code words they came up, so when they were talking the dedicated phone line they would know what they were talking about without having to, you know. Yeah, you can't make this stuff up, right? I mean,
how's Miss Cho doing? How are preparations of her dressing yes. table coming along? Will Is she be able to complete? Braid her hair on October 10th as planned? Or
isn't it the case that American nuclear program has also attracted lots of silly names? I mean, the bombs get cutesy names.
Yeah.
And there is also some odd, you know, difference with the treatment of nuclear weapons. I mean, you know,
sure.
the president gets the nuclear football following him around, and he can just, you know, instantly launch a nuclear weapon without the usual process for war. So it doesn't seem that surprising that the Chinese also have cutesy names and a different strategy for their nuclear arsenal.
That's a good point, Jeremy.
But turning to another increasingly deadly threat, what about cyber, Taylor? Where does that sit? And when did cyber become part of China's military strategy?
So cyber, I think, first becomes part of military strategy in the 2004 adjustment to the 1993 strategy. And this is one that is made to highlight informatization as the conditions under which wars will occur. And you see China here studying pretty closely the Kosovo War as well as the Iraq War, but also becoming much more concerned after the Kosovo War about a future potential conflict with the United States and trying to understand some of America's vulnerabilities. And one vulnerability they identified was the fact that the American military used unsecured networks for its logistics, and thus those could be hacked and potentially disrupted, thus not crippling the United States, but certainly hampering its ability to fight for a period of time.
Right.
At the same time, you have kind of the overall rise of the internet. And so China, like everyone else, I think, is paying more attention to cyber. But where it really, I think, comes into play is in the 2014 strategy. Because at, around this time, you see a centralization or re-centralization of cyber units under the CMC and what is created in 2016 known as the Strategic Support Force, which basically has two main functions. One is cyber operations in particular, and the other has to do with things related to space. And so in this way, cyber is seen as something supporting all PLA operations, both from a command and control perspective, because the idea under informationized conditions or informationized warfare is the real-time acquisition, collection, processing of information to facilitate joint operations and command units efficiently and effectively. And so cyber, on the one hand, is an enabler of military effectiveness in that way, but on the other hand, specific cyber weapons are also something that the PLA can now envision using if it has to in a conflict, especially with a country that is quite dependent, like the United States is, on computer networks.
That's right. So, Taylor, you dangle a tantalizing little bit at the end of the book about how, given the fact that China is always determined to sort of keep up with technological advances, and given the obvious applicability of all these advanced technologies to defense, could China go from a state that merely sort of watches warfare in the international arena and takes notes and then adjusts to become actually a state that others are going to begin emulating, a state that is, it's actually pioneering new ways in warfare? How likely is this, and how would you relate that to what we're seeing right now, this sort of effort by the Trump administration and by hawks within the broader American political scene to decouple from China technologically?
So I think those two are separate, but let me take the first part of the question first. So I think before, right, in some ways, Chinese military was quite reactive to what was happening around it because it was catching up both in terms of its inherent military power, but also in terms of its defense, industrial, technological base. But now China has reached a point, right, where it's beginning to innovate pretty significantly in certain areas of high technology and is on a trajectory, it would appear, right, to become even more innovative. And this could then open a new pathway to changing strategy that I talked about earlier, namely ideas that might percolate about how China could use these technologies that it's creating and innovating to transform war fighting. And so I certainly think China is more able to do this now and than ever before, which is why I sort of dangled it out there in the conclusion. I can't say if and when it will happen,
sure,
right? Because it has a lot to do with probably context and the nature of the technologies that are developed. But I certainly think China is now sort of able to do that in a way that it simply wasn't able to do even in 1993 or 2004, right? And this is a really significant change, and it opens up new possibilities. And I think it shows that China has potential to be a leader in military affairs and not just a follower, although it remains to be seen how they'll lead and when they do it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This certainly suggests that decoupling might be a good strategy and principle for the U.S. to pursue. But on the other hand, I don't think it's going to stunt Chinese innovation, right? I think it might cripple, to some degree, Chinese companies for a period of time, but it also could create even greater incentives for China to have indigenous technologies that it currently doesn't have. And so, ironically, it could perhaps backfire from a military perspective if it sort of accelerates China's own process of developing indigenous technologies and
that's
thinking
right
about how it might
apply. I mean, that was my thinking. It's just having them sort of still continue to be dependent on and sort of entangled with American technologies seems advantageous to us.
And the damage is already done, right? The Huawei engineers are already working 7 days a week.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think China always wanted an indigenous capacity anyway, but this certainly accelerated the process.
Taylor, to close out with the last question that may give our listeners sweet dreams or perhaps nightmares, depending on how you answer it. We read a lot about carrier-killing missiles, drone swarms, artificial intelligence used for warfare, space warfare, rail guns, and other scary stuff that the Chinese military is developing.
Hypersonic weapons, yeah.
Yeah, hypersonic weapons. What would a sober-minded analyst say about all of this stuff?
That's a very good question.
Not well, being
I
mean, one.
I'm not assuming you're sober-minded.
I think, you know, you see China certainly exploring the military potential of a lot of technologies. And this, I think, is a kind of a long-standing feature of China's approach to military technology, where it wants to have some sense of what it takes to develop a capability, especially if it knows that other countries are doing so. So hypersonics is a good example, because China's not the only country developing them. The United States is, Russia is. I think even India did a hypersonic test recently. And so if hypersonics become sort of more widely used, then China would want to be able to compete in that way. But it doesn't necessarily mean that China is going to prioritize or emphasize all of these technologies that we just talked about. So I think you see China wanting to understand what sort of the global technological trends are, how they might apply to warfare. And a lot of what you see in China, with respect to drone swarms, are also being explored in this country. And so it is too soon to tell, I think, what this means. I think what it does mean is that China is actively exploring how to make its military as competitive as possible. But one also has to consider what are the downsides of deploying these technologies. China wants to build an informationized force, right? That's going to rely increasingly on space assets. And so it's also developing counter space weapons, which means that if it does want to militarize space, or if it engages in kinetic operations in space, its own assets might be attacked, right? And really then how capable would the PLA be if it didn't have access to satellites in space? And so all of these things have a double edge, are in some ways a double-edged sword, that you want to be able to know what your adversary might do, but on the other hand, you might be deterred from using them yourself because you also know what the consequences would be for your own ability to conduct military operations.
Indeed.
You want to own Pandora's box, you just don't want to open it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure some of these boxes will get opened and applied, and others won't. China, as I think Julian Gewirtz wrote about recently, right? Alvin Toffler was, a huge sensation in China a few decades ago.
And
you sort of see analogs to this in the PLA, where they are really actively looking at everything that's going on. And then, because they've got a pretty robust R&D budget, they can sort of explore these technologies. But the question is, when do you shift from sort of exploring the technology or even mastering it to systematically implementing it into your warfighting platforms, and thus changing how you approach warfare? And that, I think, is simply hard to predict in advance.
Taylor Fravel, thank you so much for taking the time, and congrats on getting out this really important book. Your knowledge in this area is just stupefying. Anyway, let's move on to recommendations. But first, I do want to remind listeners that the Seneca Podcast is powered by SupChina. If you like what we're doing with the Seneca Podcast or other podcasts in our network, one of the best ways you can show your support is by signing up for SupChina Access, which entitles you to all sorts of good things and will make you a smarter and better informed observer of China. If you haven't been receiving the premium daily newsletter that Jeremy and his team are putting together, you are really missing out. It's just fantastic. So thank you in advance. On to recommendations. Jeremy, kick us off.
Okay, I would like to re-recommend something that I recommended some time ago on the show. It's the summer has kicked in here in Tennessee in the woods, and all kinds of plants are blooming. And I've been heavily using PlantNet, which is an app that has, you can take a photo of a flower or a leaf or a piece of bark and upload it, and it uses some kind of deep learning to identify it. And it's really, really extraordinarily accurate. And it's a really wonderful way of learning about the plants around you. So it's called PlantNet. You can, if you sort of join it, you can contribute and thus actually make it more accurate.
Yeah, that's actually the deep learning. It's just a bunch of experts who look at, I think that is a rhododendron.
But then they plug it into a computer. I know.
But it's great. No, we use it. We use it here all the time.
Human-enabled deep learning.
Yeah. All right. Good recommendation. Good re-recommendation. Taylor, what do you have for us?
So I've got two. On the theme of the PLA, I wanted to recommend a book that just came out a couple months ago on the PLA reforms. It's called Chairman Xi Remakes the PLA. It was edited by Phil Saunders at the National Defense University, along with a couple of other people. But it's only 800 pages long. So if you thought my book was long,
that'll be easy.
You'll want to buy this one. But it really probably has the best analysis in the individual chapters of how the PLA is being transformed organizationally.
Well, okay.
My second recommendation, if I can make two, is a book I haven't read yet, but I did take a look at the e-examination copy. It's called Making China Modern by a German historian whose name is Klaus Mulhahn, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And it looks at sort of the rise of China sort of from the height of the Qing in the mid-1700s until today, and I think tries to identify a lot of the institutional similarities and how those have been used or not used to build China into the country that it's become. But it seems to sort of tries to bridge this idea that everything changed after 1949, or even everything changed after 1978, and really kind of, I think, looks at kind of the deep structure of the Chinese state. So I'm really excited to read it. I just haven't had a chance to do so. So perhaps by recommending it, I will encourage myself to get cracking.
I need to read it. It's sitting on my shelf. I'm looking at it, staring at it right now. It's got this great subtitle, it's called From the Great Qing to Xi Jinping. It even rhymes. So that book again is Klaus Mulhahn, Making China Modern. Yeah, it's sort of an update, I've heard, to Spence's Search for Modern China. Really psyched. I mean, I've cracked it, looked at a few pages. The writing's terrific. If English isn't his native language, man, he's mastered it really well. It's an excellent book so far. Great recommendation, Taylor. Thank you. Mine, I want to do something slightly nepotistic. I want to recommend another podcast in our network. One episode in particular, which is the interview by Jordan Schneider of the China Econ Talk podcast with Peter Hessler. It's just a reminder that when it comes to Pete Hessler, it's not hype. It's all really there. His sense for a story is just really enviable economy with language. It's just amazing. Even when he's just talking, it's just all the things that make him great. He's just still got this sort of humility and this kind of, he's just such a great guy. Jordan's show, China Econ Talk, is fantastic. You guys have to be listening to that. He's a really gifted interviewer, gets some really great guests, gets really deep into really important topics. So lots of gems in that back catalog. I urge all listeners to delve into that. I love all my children equally, though. Anyway, Taylor, thank you once again for coming on. We look forward to having you back on again, maybe to talk about more of this.
Yeah, thank technology you. This is great. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Yeah, well, we appreciate it. Looking forward to more work from you.
Excellent.
Jeremy, good talking to you, man.
Yeah, thanks, Taylor. Thanks, Kaiser.
All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News, and make sure to check out all our other podcasts, the Caixin Seneca Business Brief, the Pan Daily Tech Buzz China, China Econ Talk, our two shows focused on women, New Voices and Ta for Ta, and the Middle Earth Podcast about the culture industry in China. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week. Take care.